Well, hello and welcome to all of you and to Palestine Deep Dive. Welcome to all of you from right across the world who I know are watching today, and we're looking forward to hearing from many of you later on. Every week here at Palestine Deep Dive, we look at the big issues in the Middle East and with a special focus on Palestine. And we also have take a wider look at global issues, global politics and international developments, what's making the news and what isn't. And we're very keen to hear from you, so do start sending your questions in. Let us know who you are, where you are, and we'll put your questions to our very special guest here today, Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. And it's a great delight to be joined by Dr. Ashrawi. She's in Ramallah. She's recently recovered from COVID-19, and we'll be exploring some of the issues around that, of course. But most of you will know about Dr. Ashrawi, but for those of you who don't, it's a little bit difficult to know where to begin because it does look as though she's packed seven lives into one. She served as a member of the Palestinian Leadership Committee and as an official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, beginning with the Madrid Peace Conference of 1991. In 1996, she was appointed as the Palestinian Authority Minister of Higher Education and Research. Prior to that, she was Dean of the Faculty of Arts at Birzeit University. Dr. Hanan Ashrawi was elected to the Palestinian Legislative Council, representing Jerusalem in 1996, and she was re-elected for the Third Way block ticket in 2006, making history as the first woman to hold a seat in the highest executive body in Palestine. She was elected as member of the Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization in 2009, and in 2018. She resigned from the PLO late last year. Dr. Ashrawi, thank you very much. And I just wondered if I could begin. And really, this is to for you to look back, if you will, over the many years of struggle in which you've been a key and committed player. And really, with all of that experience, with all of that knowledge, what you've seen, what you've been through, what your people have been through, I just wonder, I mean, are you looking ahead? Are you essentially an optimist? Are you hopeful? Do you think things will get better?
Well, first of all, let me thank you, Mark, for hosting me. And please try to call me Hanan. It's easier than Ashrawi. and I'll call you Mark if you don't mind.
Of course.
Okay. It's great to be with you. And since you started with a sort of historical perspective and a long-term view, since it's been a long time, I can give you the context. It will take a very long time to recite. But at the same time, I want to tell you the situation is much too serious, much too grave, much too dangerous to be approached from an existential mood point of view. I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I deal with reality in a way that engages and attempts to change things. I feel if you become a victim of reality, if you become passive, you become a victim. And if you base your life on moods and existential atmospheres and so on, then you won't be able to be an active or proactive instrument of change and defiance, so to speak. But right now, I think we are undergoing one of the most difficult periods of Palestinian history, of our lives, one of the most challenging. We have still not recovered from one of the worst phases with the Trump administration, mm-hmm. the Trump period in which he attempted to bash the Palestinians into submission, and of course failed, like everybody else who has attempted to force the Palestinians to their knees or to surrender. And we are still in the midst, in the grip of the coronavirus. We are still in the midst of a situation which is the most pervasive form of control and injustice, which is the Israeli occupation. In addition, of course, to the Palestinians in exile and refugees who are also part of the comprehensive system of injustice that the Palestinians suffer. In that sense, we can say the situation is very grim. But if we take a longer view, you will see how the Palestinians have been so resilient, so persistent, so adamant at maintaining their rights and their humanity, and at persisting in their in living on their land, and even those who are in exile, whatever they are, refugees, expats, exiles, they maintain their sense of identity and belonging. And they've not just internalized the cause, they've become, you know, part of the forces for change and for witness, not just advocacy of the cause. And that's why I think in the long term, in the long run, if you take a futuristic view, the Palestinians will prevail. Palestine is not about to disappear. Contrary to what the early Zionist movement wanted to do, to eradicate a whole nation, as Ilan Pape said, displacement, replacement paradigm, to displace a whole nation and to replace it with another, whether it is physically, whether it is in terms of geography or demography or culture or history or identity, we are here. And this gives me the assurance that the Palestinians have never been in the habit of surrendering or giving up or losing hope or losing faith or losing the sense of their own self and their own rights. And in the long run, we are going to prevail.
Well, hello. Yeah. I just had a message from Heather Fomeni. And she says, I'm really thrilled to be present at this webinar since Dr. Ashrawi is one of my favorite people and obviously one of my favorite politicians. And from Italy, Lucha, Italy. I hope I've got the pronunciation right. But anyway, now you said in an interview a few years back, I think of myself essentially as a human being with a multidimensional mission. Basically, I'm a Palestinian, I'm a woman, I'm an activist and a humanist, more than being a politician. And at the same time, I feel that quite often things are thrust upon us rather than come as a result of a calm and deliberate choice. And that got me thinking, because when I think about career politicians, they don't wait to have things thrust upon them. It's all often about them. And it's clearly never really been about you. That's the interesting thing to me. But my question is, you know, given that your late father was one of the founders of the PLO, I mean, I don't really suppose that you had much choice in the matter. It was thrust on you from an early age, wasn't it, really?
Not through my father at all. My father attended the first meeting of the PLO in Jerusalem in 1964, and he was certainly recruiting. But like most parents, he attempted to shield us from a very painful and unstable situation. And we spent a very sheltered childhood, so to speak, my sisters and I. But I've always said, as a Palestinian, you cannot avoid to stay outside the course of history. You cannot afford a sense of, let's say, carelessness or lack of attention to what's happening. You cannot live in a bubble. And so to me, my first confrontation with the occupation was when I went to AUB, to Beirut, Lebanon. And the 1967 war was a shocker for me, even though my father did tell me that this, he showed me from the balcony of our house that this coast is Israel. It was Palestine. Mm-hmm. Now it's Israel, but I'm sure that they will expand and sooner or later they will come to our house, to this place, to where we are. And to me, that was really unconscionable, unthinkable. How can they, you know, they've taken Palestine, they've taken the coast, now they're going to move further and further and reach our house. But anyway, it became, of course, a reality. And when I saw in Lebanon, when I went to Beirut, and I saw the fate of the refugees, and I saw the misery, the lack of rights, the denial even of identity, of respect, of everything. That's when I said it's no longer my father's and my parents' responsibility, it's mine. Mm-hmm. And with 67, it definitely became my generation's responsibility. So if you're a Palestinian, wherever you go, you're defined by your identity, by your name. You're defined by what kind of injustice you're undergoing. You're defined by all sorts of intrusive attitudes, even by others where you are labeled. I know when I was in the university in the States, people used to think I was a terrorist, you know, automatically. Ah, you're a Palestinian. You must be a terrorist. Or the exotic Orientalist approach, you know. You must know how to do belly dancing and so on. So you are always defined by others, but reality intrudes in the most horrible ways when you are subject to this type of occupation and control.
Well, Helen, I wanted to ask you, because
activity. Yeah.
You were talking about these early experiences and what I guess politicized you and you felt it thrust upon you. But tell us something, if you will, about when you were growing up, because I gather your family was in the end moved to Jordan. So what was your experience as a young woman in Palestine?
Well, they didn't move to Jordan, actually. They were in... It's a long history. I don't know whether we want to go through that. But my father was a doctor, a medical officer in the Palestine Army. So we used to move. They used to move. For I was born 2 years in every city in Palestine. So in every city, they had a daughter. I was born in Nablus. Then immediately they went to Tiberias. And from Tiberias, they were expelled when I was a child in 1948. So the family ran away, went to Jordan for a short period, then came back to Ramallah. And Ramallah is the place where my father's family comes from. We belong to one of the seven clans of Ramallah, the founders of the city, so to speak. So he came back home through Jordan. and so he experienced, you know, the violence of the creation of the state of Israel, the expulsion, going to Jordan, then the whole family came back to Ramallah, which became, of course, under Jordanian rule for a while, and so on. So it's just a long story. I don't want to go through every phase, because otherwise it becomes a narrative of history. But let me say that As a Palestinian, you have in many ways very little choice unless you decide that you want to regain your voice and agency and be an instrument of change. And that's what I decided. I never chose to be a politician, for example. I don't like being a politician. I always wanted to work in human rights and civil society. And
I was going to ask you about that, actually. Yeah.
So I don't see myself...
Your academic career has been a fascinating one, and
yes,
I suppose the question would be that in the sort of late 60s, the 70s, early 80s, was there a greater feeling of confidence amongst Palestinians that actually they could achieve change, that the forces that were aligned against them could be met? Was there more confidence back then, would you say, than that?
Yes, yeah. Certainly. Yes, there was confidence. There was a sense, of course, I belonged to the student revolution at that time. Mm-hmm. And we felt our generation could change the world. It was the tail end of the Vietnam War. It was a student revolution all over the world. In Paris, of course, you remember. All these things gave us hope that empowered us. We felt we had the energy and we had the vision and we had the courage and perhaps a sense of a responsibility to be able to take risks, to move, to change, to challenge. And we did. In many ways, we did. And the Palestinians mobilized, the PLO became active, I mean, 64 and later on. I joined the General Union of Palestine Students. I ran for office. And I was elected to the conference in 69 in Jordan and so on. So people felt, my generation, and something sometimes I feel sad that this generation doesn't have. We felt that we could come to grips with reality and we could, you know, sort of grab it and change it by sheer acts of will and rebellion. No? And to us, it was exhilarating. Huh? And we challenged the occupation, we challenged the forces of injustice, we challenged the oppressive or totalitarian regimes. We were part of a world revolution. That's where we met people like the ANC and in the States. I met the Black Students Alliance, for example, or I was first exposed to the women's movement. So we were part of a global revolutionary movement.
Mm-hmm. And well, I mean, the good thing today, Hanan, is that, you know, we are joined from people all over the world who, you know, who, some people who are watching this sending it, who are very active on Palestine.
Absolutely.
And I'll read you a couple of messages. This is from Suzanne Noble. Shukran Jazlin.
Jazilan
Hanan. I'm happy to hear you speak, and I enjoyed listening to you at the Palestine Writers Festival and following.
Thank you.
Saif says, first, I'd like to extend my best wishes to Dr. Hanan's health in light of her recovery. And he's got a question. My question is, in light of the growing rejection of the two-state solution by Palestinians and views that it's now impossible, when will the Palestinian leadership consider working towards a form of one-state solution, and should it?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. But let me just go back to the solidarity. I want to tell you that we are heartened now by a sense of solidarity and by public opinion and by a movement that has included us in it, whether it is among minorities, whether it is among women or even academic institutions, LGBTQ, all these movements, the Black Lives Matter, they have embraced us. They made Palestine part of the conversation, a global conversation, and they broke many taboos, even Bernie Sanders, the taboo of talking about Palestinian rights and self-determination and so on. So you do have a network of solidarity. There are lots of Jewish groups that are absolutely, I mean, priceless in terms of their advocacy and in terms of the message that they send, the defiance that they have. So we feel empowered in that sense, even though official governmental circles are regressing, are becoming more closed and in many ways more intimidated. And they succumb to the injustice that Israel exercises and practices, and they enable it in a sense, and give it the right to act with impunity without any accountability. But that's another thing. Now, about the one state or two state, I always tell people, let's not get involved in this. Which way? What we need is to gain the Palestinian people our rights, their rights. How you define the rights? Very clearly, those under occupation want to live in freedom on their own land. Those in exile want to be able to return and live in freedom on their own right. Those who are fragmented all over the world want to be able to be rejoined, and to be able to live with the rest of the people on their own land. So the question is not, how do we do it? One state, two state, federation, confederation, regional union, whatever. The thing is, how do we achieve those rights? And foremost is the right to self-determination. This is absolutely crucial. The right to live in freedom and dignity on your own land and to be able to take decisions pertaining to your lives. These are things that everybody else takes for granted. Now, in 1968-69, yes, the Palestinian people were the first to ask for a one-state solution. I still remember we have, I posted something on my Twitter account where my cousin Abu Omar, Hanna Mikhail, was talking about how we are fighting not just to liberate Palestine, but to liberate the Zionists and to be able to have a one-state solution where everybody can live together in democracy and equality, a non-sectarian state. This was way back in 68-69. But of course, this was turned down by everybody. Primarily by the Zionist movement, by the Israelis. And the whole world adopted the UN approach then, and I call it the colonial approach of partitioning Palestine. As you remember, it wasn't our choice to have Israel created on our land, or to have Israel take 55% of our land. It wasn't our, it was imposed on us, and that's why we keep saying Israel is an extension of a colonial past and was enacted as a result of a colonial decision. When we talk about Balfour in 2017, or when we talk about the British mandate in 1922, when we talk about the decision by several nations to take away from the people of Palestine most of their land and to give it to others, and to create an, I call it an artificial construct then, and call it Israel. And the Palestinians from then on were put under enormous pressure to accept everything as a result of this, that you have to prove yourself, you have to prove you deserve your rights, you have to prove that you are good little boys and girls, that you would not react to injustice violently, that you would not react to violence violently, that you will accept your fate and be nice, and so on. Even resistance was denied this. So the question became, how do you maintain the resilience of the Palestinian people, their ability to stay on the land, the ability to maintain their lives and the future for their children with their identity and culture and history without succumbing to all these external pressures? Now, the thing continued. It hasn't stopped. The Nakba that began in 48 is continuing and finding its ultimate now, when we see the expansion of Israel, the superimposition of Greater Israel on all of historical Palestine. So from the beginning, we're told you have to accept the partition. Then when we did in 1988, they said, no, it's not partition 181. It has to be the division 242338, which is the 67 partition or occupation. So instead of saying, okay, now you've accepted 45% of historical Palestine, no, they said you have to accept only 22%. So when the PLO accepted 22% of historical Palestine, we were told that's not enough. Israel is creating facts. You have to deal with reality. Israel is expanding, is building settlements, stealing land and resources. So you have to compromise, be good people, show that you are positive. And so it continued. Now the question is, do we want to continue down that path? Or do we want to put an end to the sense of Palestinian lack of protection and Israeli lack of accountability and this ongoing expanding project? What is the best way to do it? Now, we have to do it through the participation of all Palestinians everywhere. We have to have our own body politic and system of governance as well. Our political system has to understand that we are not living freely, exercising sovereignty on our own land. We are under occupation, and it's a very intrusive occupation. And the
there's an occupation, and also the delineation of borders and how these borders have shifted since the mandate. All of this chronicled as we well know at the United Nations and elsewhere. But there is a question that leads on from this. I'm departing from my question sheet, by the way, because we're getting so many in from people from all over the place. And Julie, who is chair of Sheffield in England, Sheffield Labour Friends of Palestine, says, and it leads on from what you were saying, really, should the international solidarity movement's first focus be Israeli apartheid?
Yes, it is a situation of apartheid. We should confront this enormous injustice, the way it was confronted in South Africa. When we talk about BDS, for example, it's a civil society initiative where individuals and firms and so on can act responsibly and can act on the basis of their own conscience and choices to choose not to deal with Israeli products or settlement products and so on. But even that has been criminalized, as though if you dare hold Israel to account, even as an individual, you will be punished. But apartheid is part of the whole picture. When we started, Mark, I talked about the situation of pervasive control and injustice. They control every aspect of their life. If it were only apartheid, yes, it would be South Africa, and it would be a situation of one group of people totally oppressing another in a variety of ways. But I still believe in something that Ilan Pape wrote, and I always quote him, and you can die. Keep telling him this is my favorite statement. He keeps saying, and he wrote in his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, that this is a displacement-replacement paradigm. So to take part of it and to take the discriminatory separation and control part is one thing. But to look at it in context as a history of control, expulsion, ethnic cleansing, silencing, creating forged realities, and of course, creating counter narratives in order to falsify this reality and to negate our own narrative. It's amazing when you see how they change the names of streets, for example, in Jerusalem from Arabic to Hebrew names. When you see how they, when they build a settlement next to a Palestinian village, they give it the name that the Hebrew equivalent of the Arabic name. They're competing over presence, over history. Now when they excavate, for example, this hurts a lot because there's a big, big war now, a big campaign to take over our archaeological historical sites. And it's incredible because they're attempting to subjugate this, their, our own continuous history in Palestine. And of course we go back thousands of years. You cannot tell us you don't. I mean, I can trace my history, my family, hundreds of years. We are the earliest, we are the heirs of the earliest Christian tradition in the world. So they cannot tell us your accidents of history, or don't talk about the past when they try to recreate, you know, the Hebrew tribes a few thousand years ago. So in a sense that they're attempting to superimpose not just a grid and a reality and an infrastructure on Palestinian territory, they're attempting to superimpose a narrative on our own history and an identity which is ideologically based, which is absolutist, which excludes the others and claims privilege, entitlement, and preferential treatment over our own. And not only that, but they reverse the situation to turn us into the culprits, into terrorists, violent people. So if we're non-existent, if we don't have a history, if we don't have rights, if we're invisible.
Of course, and I mean, it's interesting to you there. I mean, you know, if you were describing a situation whereby a group of people moved into the Sahara, where there had been an ancient civilization, or Assyria in northern Iraq, where there had been an ancient, and there were no longer any people, you could see that this move could eventually be successful. But in terms of Palestine, as we all know, and as people are reminding me here, if you look at the historical Palestine and you look at the populations of people, the Palestinians, including Palestinians who've been exiled to the camps in Jordan and Lebanon, actually comprise probably near enough a majority. So you can do your very best to wipe out a culture and push a people to it, but you're all still there. And yes. I suppose this is the big, big question. People are asking this all over the place, really, is, well, you know, if it's not about a two-state solution or a one-state solution, how does Palestine go about it re-establishing establishing itself once again as a secular state, and possibly a democratic state, hopefully, the sort of society, the sort of polity that you've been fighting for all these years? How does it go about doing so?
Well, of course, by democratic means. we do have a long history, even under occupation and before that. Palestine, unfortunately, has been under occupation for a very long time. It's not just the Israeli occupation, from the Ottoman days and before that to the British Mandate and so on. So the problem is that Palestine has never been entirely free. It has always been controlled by others. It has always been subject to other people's greed and sense of expropriation and appropriation. So the thing lies right now, the answers, as you implied, rightfully remain within the Palestinian people. How do we treat each other? How do we deal with our own needs? How do we maintain our own resilience? How do we maintain our connectivity? And our identity, not as an exclusivist or act of superiority, but as an inclusive system of humanity. How do we do that? And we do that through elections, through electing without being subject to Israeli diktat, of course. And I believe elections are a means, but not an end unto themselves. And they are not the overall system of democracy, as you very well know. People can elect people who become dictators, and you have elections for one time only and so on. No, you need to have a system of respect for rights and freedoms. You have to have the institutions that can function in that way as a just system of good governance that respects the entirety of the people, that listens to their voice, that are open and transparent and accountable, and that in many ways will accept the judgment of the people through elections. And if you don't have just laws, if you don't have separation of powers, if you don't have access to an independent judiciary, if you do not have a language, not just a discourse, but the practice of rights, then you cannot do your own people justice. And I've written somewhere that the worst thing are the self-inflicted wounds. I mean, we are used to externally inflicted wounds all the time. But when we do it to ourselves, that's where it becomes unbearable. So that's where we have to roll up our sleeves and to work in order to do justice to ourselves and to each other, knowing that everything we are undergoing is, in a sense, a transition. We are in a state of flux, but the permanence must be our presence on our land, our commitment to our rights, and, as I said, our collectivity and joint vision.
And then I'm going to read out a few questions and messages from people from around the place to you, beginning with Boris Kakas. He's from Slovakia. Best regards from Slovakia. Dear Dr. Ashrawi, what would be the realistic best case scenario for Palestinians now in post-Trump era? Fahid Abu Akel says, thanks for your leadership. You are the best for defending the Palestinian cause for freedom. What is the best way to end the Israeli brutal occupation? I think we've been talking about that. Kate Scott, I never cease to be touched and humbled by the resilience and perseverance of Palestinian people in the occupied territories. In our own small way, we continue to advocate and try to persuade our government to support justice for Palestinians rather than engaging in the arms trade with Israel. That's from Kate in Northampton in the UK. Greetings from Edinburgh. This is Halla George. Proud of you, Hanan, reassuring you and others, Palestine every day for our lives. Suzanne Noble says, I also quote Ilan frequently. I think his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, should be mandatory reading.
Yeah.
John Whitbeck in Paris. John's got a question. And you'll know, John, if elections are held this year, do you see any hope that a new third party, younger and more creative, could provide a meaningful electoral alternative to Fatah and Hamas? Maybe we'd take John's question first, Hanan, we go on to take a few more as well after that.
Okay. Hi, John. Let me say hi to Kate, to Halla George. I hope you and your family are doing well. I'm sure Ramallah misses you. John, look, we tried the third way in the elections of 2005, 2006, as you know. We did get a couple of seats, but the Palestinian political scene is still being gripped by two major parties, movements, they call themselves, Fatah and Hamas. Now, with Fatah, you have a few very small factions, most of whom will not pass the threshold for seats in parliament. And at the same time, Hamas, you know, has, let's say, a standard number of people, and it hasn't diversified in Gaza. And you have the left-wing parties who have become also very small, and if they want to stand a chance of getting seats, then they would have to unify their efforts. The worst thing would be is if everybody decides to run together, and then they will have a nationalist, and then they will deprive the Palestinian people of the right to choose by having a whole one list that will probably act against the independence. But to me, the question is, how do you get young people and women and professional people and people of integrity? We have amazing human beings, amazing Palestinians, young, promising people, active and strong women. We have lots of potential, lots of human resources who have been deprived for a long time from the right to be at the table, the right to take decisions, the right to be part of the decision-making in Palestine at all levels. But we also have a strong women's movement and we have a strong now youth movement. What happens depends now on, first of all, the law, because we had asked to reduce the age for taking a position to 21. It used to be 28. And they haven't done that. And then we had taken a decision in the Palestine National Council, as you remember, Central Council, for women to be at least 30%, at least 30%, as a form of affirmative action. We ended up now with the new law with 26% women, and we don't know why. There are other issues that have to be dealt with the law. But if the factions want to run on their own list, then we have to make sure that they have enough women and young men and women at the forefront and places and guaranteed places where they would pass, instead of having them in a place that would ensure that the men and the usual suspects would get the positions. We also have to make sure that we have a support system for these elections. If they don't want to run within the factions, that in many ways, if you look at the public opinion polls, John, you will see that many people are disgruntled. They do not like or trust the leadership, not just Fatah or Hamas, even the whole political system. They are desperate to see change, and they have to be themselves the change. Now, but we have to make room for them. One reason why I resigned was to practice what I preached, was to show and maybe to trigger change and to say that you can leave office, that you can make room for others, and that you can support and encourage young people to be part of decision-making. It's their time, for heaven's sake. And I said at the beginning, I told you, Mark, I feel sorry that they don't have this sense of exuberance and daring and support that they can engage and change, because suddenly we ended up with a very ossified, rigid system and with the same people in place constantly, year after year after year, to the point where even the different factions and the progressives and the left wing and so on, they are all the same. You cannot just accuse Fatah and Hamas of hogging power and position. Now is the time to dislodge this. Now is the time to challenge. I know it's not going to happen over time, overnight, John. I know that it's going to be very difficult. Perhaps we can get in some people. We have a support system for young, for women leadership, which we've worked with. We have a support system for young men. Now, whether they can form together a bloc that can make some space, they're not going to be able to challenge Fatah and Hamas entirely.
Hannah, as you're talking, I'm wondering, I mean, do you see a new generation coming through? I mean, also, I mean, the obvious question is, would you think of standing as well? I mean, there have been so many, as you say, we used to set the same faces for a very, very long time, elections delayed, but now they're going to happen. Now is a great opportunity. But with youth and enthusiasm, there must also be experience and wisdom. So do you see this new generation, and would you think about doing it yourself?
Well, I didn't resign in order to re-enter. I said I have never abandoned the cause, and I never will, and I will continue to work, and I prefer to work from within civil society. I do not need an official position to be able to be effective. Frankly speaking, I was less effective because I stayed in the PLO executive trying desperately to change from within, to challenge from within. And it's very difficult. And you can't be just a lone voice in the wilderness. You have to have people around you. But I think we can bring about change from outside if we manage to organize. We cannot organize only in cyberspace or mobilize in cyberspace and virtual reality. We have to organize on the ground. You have to bring out the vote. Women and the young men and qualified people have to work together in order to make a quantitative difference, not just a qualitative difference. I'm running, very frankly. I told everybody, I don't want to run, but I will support the right candidates, and I will campaign for the right candidates. And right now I'm engaged in dialogue, in conversations, lots of discussions with young men and women who are exploring the possibilities and means of running. And I hope they will be able to run in order to make a difference. And they will find support from me and like-minded people and others who want to help them get to their proper place and not to continue to be excluded or marginalized. And that's, I think that's where I can make a difference. But we have to tell people that it's not a sense of entitlement. I was elected many times to every position, except I was appointed as minister, but and I told everybody I've refused more positions than I've accepted. But the thing is, how do you also understand the requirements of the moment and the era and the age? How do you do justice to your own people? How do we make room for these promising young people? And hopefully, if we do manage to help them get to where they want to, then that is how you begin the process of change.
And
it's not going to be overnight, yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, I'm just going to take a few more points from, and one or two other questions from people around the world, sending them in. Ashjan Lulu says, thank you, Dr. Ashrawi. It's great to have the chance to listen to you today. I have a question for you. You are perceived as a peace builder figure, the best example being given your role in the Oslo peace process and negotiations with the Israeli occupiers. However, some commentators
I can't hear you. Mark?
And I beg your pardon, I just dropped out there, but I'm here back with another point from Stephen Watters.
I just heard about Oslo peace process and negotiations with Occupy, but then I didn't hear anything after that.
So Hannah, what it was, some commentators, authors and academics have criticized this liberal framework of peace building and think that Palestine is a situation of settler colonization as opposed to a conflict situation. We talked to Jeff Halper about this last week.
Yeah.
So there's that question. Stephen Watters, he says, does Dr. Hannan think we should also confront British and European support for Israel? Not really reacting properly to Israel breaking international law, continuing to trade, and how should we do that? There's been much effort to silence Palestinian voice in the British Labour Party. I know that from a talk I helped arrange with Ambassador Zomlot that Labour Friends of Palestine is being relaunched. I think these efforts would benefit massively if she could help support that. Another question. This is from Alex Bastos. You're being asked to help us out in the British Labour Party, which is a terrible mess at the moment. Alex Bastos says, greetings, Dr. Ashrawi. It's great to hear from you. I'm wishing you good health. The dispossessed refugees in Lebanon, Jordan and Syria filled the ranks of the PLO in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and their sacrifice helped put Palestine on the map. After Oslo, they appear to have been largely abandoned to face persecution in host countries and now are barely mentioned. So his question is, what role do you think the refugees and the camps can play? And what is their future? That's probably enough questions.
I think that's more than enough. We have enough to write a couple of books, you and I. I'm glad you began with Oslo, because I forgot who asked this question. I never was part of the Oslo negotiations. As you know, I was part of the Madrid talks and the Washington talks, which were based on an entirely different paradigm. Ours was dealing with the real causes first, and then dealing with technical issues and functional issues. The Oslo process is exactly the opposite. It dealt with peripheral issues, technical issues, functional issues, postponed the issues of land, sovereignty, independence, and so on, and enabled Israel to continue its control and to continue its land theft and expansion and its persecution of the Palestinians, and to continue transforming the character of Jerusalem and annexing So I don't want to go into detail when I wrote and spoke about all the flaws and shortcomings and dangers inherent built-in systems of weakness within the Oslo process. Many people were upset. Why are you criticizing this? I thought we thought you were a peace. Of course I want peace. I think of peace as a right. It is not something, it is not a condescending gift. It is a right. Other people live in peace on their own land. We have the right to live in peace. It's not a dirty word, even though it's become a dirty word because of the process that, in a sense, sorry, became an end unto itself and was used as a means of perpetuating the occupation and Israeli control. Ultimately, there will be negotiations, ultimately. But how, on what basis, what terms of reference, what is the balance of power, what are the principles, and what is the objective? You do not enter into negotiations as a fishing expedition, and you do not negotiate with your occupier alone. This is against the Fourth Geneva Convention, by the way, because people under occupation cannot sign agreements with their occupier because they might be signed under duress. So the negotiations are a means, are a tool. If they are flawed and if they have not delivered, then you look for other tools or you look for another system. But you do not hold on to a system that has failed, thinking that they will change. That's why I'm impatient with people, particularly Europeans, who keep saying, all we need is to go back to direct bilateral negotiations. What? Since 91. This is what's been happening. The US, the strategic ally of Israel, entered or became the sponsor of the talks in order to weigh in favor of Israel in the talks. The Europeans abandoned their will, frankly speaking, and did not want to enter into any confrontation or work at any cross purposes with the US. Of course, we understand that Israel is created or was created as a result of a Western political world. It is a white Western Christian invention, so to speak. And we know that they have ties, whether they have colonial ties or economic ties or intelligence ties or guilt ties or whatever with Israel, that set limits to how they can hold Israel accountable, to how they can make Israel behave within the realm of a multilateral rights-based, rules-based system. That's why Israel feels entitled. It's above the law. It will never be held accountable. As it says, Europe can say whatever it wants, provided we do whatever we want. And it has always had the US. The US was always the patron of Israel. But then it became the partner of Israel under Trump, and I call them a partner in crime, because this US administration took steps, illegal, unilateral steps, like the Jerusalem and recognition of it as capital, moving the embassy, attacking UNRWA and so on, defunding Palestine, recognizing annexation of the Golan Heights. The US became an instrument for Israeli occupation and expansion. Now this has to stop and this has to be totally unraveled, so to speak. But it's not, the paradigm is not peace building, because you cannot build peace under occupation. There are several components to this paradigm. When we're talking about apartheid, yes, it is an apartheid situation. It is not a situation of conflict where it is even-handed and you have a border dispute and so on. Because when you have the Palestinians totally deprived of every right, including the right to live in freedom and dignity on their own land, then you do not bring the victim to negotiate. It's like you do not bring the victim of rape to negotiate with a rapist. This doesn't happen. What you need to do is create a system, as we said, of curbs and accountability for the violator and protection for the victim. This is what is needed. How you do that involves a multilateral approach and must be based on international law, not on power. Because when you talk about power, then of course, the asymmetry of power is very clear. It is Israel that not only has the weapons and the funds and the control and the immunity, but it also has the support in many ways of others. So the paradigm is dealing with a settler colonial paradigm, with an apartheid paradigm, but also with a paradigm that attempts to displace you and to negate you. It's multifaceted. I mean, the Palestinians in exile, you talk about the refugees, they are victims, are perpetual victims. There are different types of victims. The Palestinians within 48 Israel, the Palestinians of 48, are also victims of discrimination. And within 48, Israel is an apartheid system, although they claim to be the only democracy in the world. Now, within Gaza, it's also another type of discrimination, of control, of containment, and holding them within an open-air prison, a state of siege. And people, even expatriates who want to come back, denying people the right to come, no matter how well they're doing outside and so on, is also a form of persecution and injustice, because you want to be able to go back to your home, to your family.
Well, Hannah, I wonder, sadly, I mean, we're entering into the last few minutes of Palestine Deep Dive. I just wonder if we could, from what you were talking about there, you talked about the Trump administration being an enabler. You talked about the sort of European desire for Israelis and Palestinians to be having bilateral discussions again. Everything's gone into deep freeze for all the reasons that we know. But beyond that, there's been quite the explicit support for Israel. And also, by the way, which a number of our listeners and viewers have been referring to, this sort of the dampening down of criticism of Israel, because very often people do criticize Israel, and the anti-Semitism is bandied around.
Yes, of course.
Being accused of being anti-Semitic. But I suppose the question is, we're now into new territory, but is it same old territory? We have a new administration in Washington. We had this week, in fact, yesterday, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, said he hoped to see the Middle East quartet of mediators meet again in the next few weeks, now that there's a new US president in the White House. Now, is this back to where we were 5 years ago? What's going to change? And is part of the problem the United Nations, actually, and essentially the General Assembly not really getting to grips with the change situation on the ground?
Yeah. Well, going back to the quartet is going back to the status quo ante, which has failed. I know this is not conventional wisdom within Palestinian leadership. They keep asking, we want a quartet, we want a quartet. Well, at one point we said the quartet is useless. It became an instrument of American manipulation, because whenever the US wanted to create the impression that they had a multilateral or multinational involvement, they would pull out the quartet out of the mothballs and say, you can meet. But then it became an instrument of Israeli American control. And whenever they didn't need the quartet, they would put it back in the deep freeze or within the mothballs, and that's it. And the quartet accepted to play that role. It was a very strange creature. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want a quartet, then why not quartet plus? Why have an international organization represented by its secretary general? And many countries tell me we're not represented. It's only the secretary general. Then you have a regional organization, the EU. Then you have the US, the superpower. Then you have Russia. Where are the others? Where is China? where are the Arabs, for example? Where is the rest of the UN? So what we always asked for is a UN multilateral system that can implement its own laws, its own resolutions, which it has never done. We have hundreds of UN resolutions, Security Council and General Assembly. Not one has been implemented. So there is a sense of helplessness and lack of ability to implement its will, because the UN, you all know what the problems are. We're not going to go into that. Europe has also decided that the US is that the peace process or peacemaking is the monopoly of the US. And we said, no, it cannot be. But at the same time, you cannot have Palestinians and Israelis talking to each other as though we are equal and we're both free and we both have the same rights. It's not happening. So to go back, and now that Biden is here, by the way, was it today, where he said that they're not going to take back the embassy to Tel Aviv, but they will keep it in Jerusalem.
Yes. Yes.
And then they started criticizing the Palestinians. We need this false symmetry again. Mm. We are against unilateral measures, preemptive unilateral measures, such as Israeli settlements, Israeli land, Israeli blah, 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 and Palestinian incitement. Do you know what is incitement? If we dare describe the occupation, we are inciting. If we dare in our textbooks talk about the occupation, we are inciting and we are anti-Semitic and so on. And again, terrorism, what is terrorism? Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, but they consider every prisoner a terrorist, as if the Israeli judicial and military judicial system and courts are just. They imprison Palestinians for throwing a stone. They imprison Palestinians for writing something on Facebook. They imprison Palestinians. I mean, it's amazing. So all these people are terrorists, and then we are accused of funding terrorism. It's incredible how the Americans very easily slip back into the slogans and the cliches of the past and the role, and say, in order to criticize Israel's settlement activity, which is a war crime, they have to find ways in which they can criticize the Palestinians, and then they do nothing about it. Not only that, but they do not undo the injustice and the illegality of recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is illegal. And you all know that by UN. So let's not be, let's not expect miraculous changes from Biden. Within the Democratic Party, there are people who are progressives, who are open-minded, who know what the Palestinian question is, and who are breaking barriers and speaking out. But there are also what they call themselves, people like the Democratic Majority for Israel, or people who have worked as ambassadors to Israel, and Zionists who are mainstream within the Labour Party, who are trying, within the Democratic Party, who are trying to take us back to this status quo ante, which in itself failed. So if they want to do the same old thing, they will fail again, and they will make room for people like Trump to enter the arena and to create more destruction and more havoc, to wreak more havoc.
If I may just come in there, I mean, I think, you know, listening to you today, there's also a lot of hope there. There are elections happening in Palestine. You've talked very much about strongly about international solidarity. We can see it here from messages coming in. I'll read you a few. We have to finish, but there is a much greater degree of awareness. One of the issues we really didn't get time to talk about today, unfortunately, is the pandemic and the fact that Israel, which is responsible under international law for ensuring that Palestinians whose lands are occupied are also vaccinated, have simply done nothing. I think 500 vaccinations is what has been offered. But this has been very, very visible to a lot of people who are not necessarily well-informed, not necessarily very political. But it does seem, and from so much that you said today, that there is a lot of hope. There are a lot of young people. They're a lot better informed, and a lot more, a lot sharper, perhaps, and can see through the compromises of old. And that's why the last question, where you responded to it about the return of the quartet, is interesting, because people clearly are not going to go back to all of that sort of stuff again. Hannah, I'm just going to leave with you a few messages from people. Stephen Watters says, would love, this is a bid for you to go and speak, would love for Dr. Hannan to consider speaking for Hexham Labour Friends of Palestine, that's in Northumberland, I believe. Roger Waters says the UN is fettered by the Permanent Security Council members' veto. Hannan is right. He also says thank you very much for all that you do, all your work.
Thank
you. Yes, what a privilege it is to listen to Dr. Hannan today. Always remember when I was growing up with her on TV with Yasser Arafat. And people say, can we keep this going? Well, we'd love to, but we can't, you know, we can't keep Hannan forever. Very, very lucky to have you today. And we're very
grateful. My pleasure.
Very, very grateful. grateful. Thank you very much for your time. Hanan's been in Ramallah, and you've been sending in your questions and messages from all over the world. It'll be a great boost, I think, to everybody to see that Hanan is with us today. And we will just say thank you again. And to all of you watching Palestine Deep Dive, until next time, for a date for your diaries, actually, on the 24th of February, and Hanan, of course, has been talking about links with the ANC. Please join us on the 24th of February, because we're going to be joined by a former South African Defence Minister and ANC Member of Parliament, Ronnie Kasril. So, and also...
My love. Yeah.
Send your best wishes to him, Hanan. And to Kieran, Omar, Alex and Mac and all of Palestine Deep Dive who've made this possible, thank you very, very much indeed. So until next time, from me, thank you. Hanan, thank you.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Deep Dive, and thanks to everybody who participated. It's wonderful, very encouraging.